This is episode 4 of the Futures Intelligent Leadership Flowcast with Dave Snowden, founder of Cognitive Edge, and Craig Weldon, former U.S. military general. Welcome to the Futures Intelligent Leadership Flowcast. This is your host, Tyler Mongan. I am the president of Haku Global. This is a space for globally minded experts to dialogue about the future of leadership with a focus on the key question, how can leadership be more intelligent about futures? From this conversation, innovative wisdom, practical tools, and actionable insights emerge to help future-ready leaders thrive in an uncertain, complex, and exponentially changing world. Let's jump in to the dialogue. Today, in this episode, I'm joined by Dave Snowden and Craig Weldon. Dave is the founder of Cognitive Edge, which was founded in 2005 with the objective of building methods, tools, and capability to utilize insights from complex adaptive systems theory and other scientific disciplines in social systems. Even if you do not know who Dave Snowden is, you may be familiar with or even used one of his decision-making frameworks called the Knifen Framework, which he developed while at IBM to help understand the context for decision-making. If you look at his profile, you will quickly realize that he has a brilliant mind and a lot of wisdom to share. Craig Weldon has around 40 years of experience in the U.S. military, both in and out of uniform. He recently retired and authored a book titled Leadership, The Art of Inspiring People to Be Their Best. He also enjoys motivational speaking about his experiences in leadership. I had the pleasure of meeting Craig in Honolulu, Hawaii prior to his book release and found him to be very humble and authentic and a great model of leadership. In this dialogue, Dave and Craig explore contextual leadership, cognitive diversity to manage complexity, coherent teams and cultures, why many military command techniques are rooted in neuroscience, why changing process and relationship dynamics is more effective than trying to change people, the power of leadership self-awareness, the strength and limits of 360 reviews, and the importance of real-time feedback loops and leadership narrative. Let's listen. So aloha, Craig and Dave. Thank you both for joining me here on this Futures Intelligent Leadership Flowcast. And I want to just start, as always, by asking this question of what does it mean for leadership or leaders to be smart or intelligent about futures given uncertainty, complexity, and exponential change? And how does your work or your experience, how do we answer that question or address it? And I'd love to start with Dave.
I think there are several things. Probably let's run with three main ones. First of all, leaders need to be aware of context. I mean, this is something the Knifen framework is about. So if you're in a highly structured, highly constrained environment, you can manage by process and control, and you should do that. If you're in a chaotic environment, that's also draconian. But in a complex system, you're dealing with a system which doesn't have causality, so you don't get repetition. And that means you've got to manage the dispositional state or the patterns so that good things are more likely to happen. And you've also got to be finely tuned to unintended consequences, because the only thing we know for certain within a complex adaptive system is any intervention will produce unintended consequences. Yeah. And we're now actually arguing people are ethically responsible for that. So contextual awareness is one key issue. The other is the recognition of cognitive diversity. So we know that all human beings, most will scan about 5% of what's in front of them, and they'll make a decision based on the first hit pattern match with previous experience. And there's no way you can overcome that unless you're fully autistic, at least at which point you won't be in command. So building cognitive diversity into the decision process, and that can be done like with a military concept like CRUS. We do it with distributed cognitive situational assessment. You've got to introduce diversity. And the way I often explain that is if you give a bunch of radiologists a batch of x-rays, ask them to look for anomalies, and on the final x-ray, you put a picture of a gorilla, which is 48 times the size of a cancer nodule, 83% of radiologists don't see it, even their eyes scan it. So that's where you're starting to try and find the 17%. So as a leader, you need to find the people who your management is screening from you because they're seeing the world in a radically novel way. Mm. So that's contextual awareness, cognitive diversity. And then I think the final one is a key concept from philosophy of science called coherence. You can never know enough to know which pattern to follow. As a leader, you'll always be faced with 5 or 6 different alternatives. The complexity principle is if the alternative is coherent, you explore it. If it's incoherent, you don't. So I can say, for example, evolutionary theory is coherent to the facts, even though we know it's wrong, whereas young earth creation is incoherent to the facts, so I don't pursue it. So again, some of the work we do with leaders is to find very rapid assessment techniques for which hypotheses are actually coherent and then test those. Yeah. So those would be my sort of three C's of it.
Great. Thanks, Dave. Craig, so how do you typically answer this question of, you know, how do leaders be more intelligent or smart about futures?
Well, I think your readers need to understand first that I spent about 40 years with the military, 30 in uniform with the Army, and another almost 10 with the United States Marine Corps as a senior civilian. So I'm cut from the cloth of the military, and that's the way I think. There is an old saying in the military that no plan survives the first shot in a battle. And so we have been working very, very hard with the military leaders over decades, certainly since I've been associated with them, to ensure they understand the need for flexibility when they face situations that are uncommon, different from what was anticipated. And we have built in, either deliberately or intuitively, branches and sequels into our plans to make sure that we can adapt. The other thing we introduced in the military many years ago was the concept of commander's intent, which means basically that when the commander or the leader determines that there is a particular way forward that he or she would like the organization to go, they described that in an intent statement or a vision statement, so that when things do go bad and the communications fails and misunderstandings occur and people are separated by time and space, that the subordinate organizations and individuals understand what the original intent was to get there, and they can continue to march and arrive at the destination.
There's an interesting link there with some, I mean, we're doing work on commander's intent already. We're trying to reduce the information flow, but increase the richness of the associated narrative. And I first present, there's a link here, because I first presented this at Quantico at Marine University, and then more recently at the War College up in Rhode Island. And what we're working on there is a metaphor-based command language. So I'll give you the phrase we've been using for tests. So if I say little round top, no Chamberlain, I'm making a reference to Gettysburg and introducing a counterfactual. This is also what we did with the Singapore War College. So the idea is to allow a much richer contextual reference with counterfactuals to get people to think differently. But I mean, I completely agree that the intent statements is the most vital one, because you can only handle uncertainty if you have a degree of ambiguity over command. So that there's a lot more work to do there. But I think we're trying to get this very succinct 3 or 4 word communication with rich meaning behind it, which is also a form of coded language, and to provide better feedback into the system as well.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. We used to have a 5-paragraph field order, which was standard across the United States military, mission, situation, execution, logistics, command and signal. Yeah. And about 30 years ago, we incorporated this concept into the execution paragraph called commander's intent. And while staff officers typically wrote the order, the commander always wrote the commander's intent, or at least he was supposed to. Oftentimes we found staff officers doing that as well. But to be a purist, the commander, the leader, the person in charge actually sat down with pen and paper and wrote the commander's intent. This is what I intend to achieve, in broad enough language and short enough and simple enough so that people who are about to execute this plan could execute it on their own if they needed to. Because again, the uncertainty of war is such that when things break down, and they inevitably do, everybody in the organization needs to understand what was the original commander's intent or the leader's intent, and how do we, even in his or her absence, how do we achieve that?
For both of you, do you find that this idea of commander's intent is being used or relevant in like corporate world?
We're starting to introduce it, and we're starting to build metaphors around that. So I think it's relevant. I think the other big thing from a military environment which is relevant is heuristics. So if you look at one of the ways Napoleon transformed warfare, he basically had a basic heuristic: if in doubt, march to the sound of the guns. Now, that may sound simple, but that was a major revolution, because before that, people, generals, issued orders. And that meant there was a self-organizing principle. And the Marines have got something similar, which is capture the high ground, stay in touch, keep moving. So heuristics give you a process. The other thing, just to reinforce what was just said, we know from a whole body of evidence, if the commander writes the order, people pay more attention to it than if their subordinates do. And people have an instinct for whether it's been written by the real commander or not. That actually counts. But heuristics are really powerful for conveying intent because they handle ambiguity.
Yeah, I'm not able to answer that question as well as David, because I've only been in the corporate world now for about 13 days. I've been appended to the federal government.
Now, well, you still got a chance.
I've been appended to the federal government and to the Department of Defense my entire life, having grown up in an Air Force family, spent 30 years in an Army uniform, and another 9 with the United States Marine Corps. So I feel like I'm broken the umbilical cord and on my way. But it certainly is my objective to take the kinds of valid lessons that we've learned in the military and help spread that word throughout the corporate world and in the next chapter in my life.
Yeah. And so, Craig, for your work, what do you see? I guess, how do you see this transition for you then? And what are you going to do anything differently than you did in the military that you will be able to do now, you think, I know it's still new, but as this corporate space?
Yeah, so I wrote a book before I left the federal government. It was published about 6 months ago. It's called Leadership, the Art of Inspiring People to Be Their Best. And I'm hoping to leverage this book, which is now an international bestseller, but to use this book as a launching pad to help get me in front of audiences who are willing to listen to these kinds of thoughts. And I think it's starting to come to fruition. These past few weeks, we've been settling in my household goods. The majority of my stuff was delivered just yesterday. Internet is being connected on Thursday in my house. And I just bought a car last week. So I'm still settling in to this new world in South Carolina. But on the 29th of October, I've got a speaking engagement in Omaha, Nebraska. And on the 4th of November, I'm a speaker on a luxury cruise line where I give 4 presentations, and one of which is going to be on my book. They bought over 100 of my books to give out free to them. And I've got a number of other leadership-related speaking opportunities that are developing in front of me. So, you know, it's yet to be determined, but I feel like I'm an acolyte for a topic which is very, very important and relevant in today's world. And it's the sort of thing that never really stales. It really doesn't. I mean, leadership is old as mankind is, and poor leadership and good leadership. And my little slice of this is about 50 years of experiences and leadership and life. And that's what I hope to pass on to the next generation before I pass on.
You got a good precedent there, and Stan McChrystal went down that route. I mean, he used my stuff in Afghanistan, so I know that stuff from Team of Teams. Yeah. Ironically, I've gone the other way. I mean, I was never in a military environment. I was in a corporate environment and an academic environment. And now I'm working with the Air Force, the Marine Corps, the US Navy and others. Yeah. And it's been quite interesting because coming in with a sort of academic commercial background and looking at the military side, one of the things which came out of that, and this, I keep saying this to executives, is you keep having these idiotic consultants come in who say they want you all to be above average, which means they're poor mathematicians because everybody can't be above average, right? And what the military have learned how to do is to take people who are below average and make them brilliant. And that's where you start to look at the models like heuristics. You start to look at the models like effectively what we call, the name's gone from me now, crews. Yeah. So in the crew concept, you're trained in role and role expectation, which means the crew can execute more than the individuals. And for example, a weapons sergeant can actually tell a brigadier what to do within certain contexts. So they delegate authority. So I actually think it's much more interesting to take the military frameworks and apply them into a commercial world and take that theme of how do you take whoever comes through the door who just signs up, comes through a recruiting office, and you've got to make them able to perform. Yeah, and that actually requires process as well as everything else.
Well, so you're definitely seeing that direct link then with your work, Dave.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I tend now to look at a military framework, and I studied military history all my life anyway, right? I tend to take military frameworks and then look at the underlying cognitive neuroscience. So my approach is look at something which works and has worked for several hundred of years, not just something that about 10 cases, try and find out scientifically why it worked. And if I can't find out scientifically, I can scale it and apply it in different contexts. So we know the cognitive neuroscience of crews. We know the cognitive neuroscience of heuristics. So we know how to scale them.
Hmm. Let me give an example, and I'd be interested in Dave's perspective of this. 40 years ago, I went through the Army's Ranger School, which is one of the premier training of environments that you're going to find in the military. It's along the lines of the SEALs and Special Forces and so forth. And that was the first time that I ever experienced peer reviews. And if you didn't pass your peer reviews, you didn't graduate from Ranger School. It's as simple as that. Because one of the things they wanted to make sure was that you were a team player and that you could work well with a team. And if under duress, which the school put you under, you didn't pull your own weight and contribute to the total effort, you would fail. Now, fast forward 26 years later, I became a brigadier general in the United States Army. And in those 26 years, I never once experienced any kind of peer reviews. And when I became a general, the Army reintroduced peer reviews, and I would get a questionnaire once a year from the chief of staff of the Army that asked three questions about my peers, other brigadier generals in the Army. Do you know this officer? If you know this officer, would you recommend him for or her for promotion? And if you know this officer, would you recommend him or her for command? Three simple questions. And if you didn't know the first question, the answer to the first question, do you know this officer? You just went to the next person. And all of this would be rolled into some algorithm and used by the chief of staff of the Army to make assignments and determine who should go into command. Now, after I took off the uniform and I became a senior civilian as part of the senior executive service for the United States Marine Corps, and I was at the Department of the Navy, SES, I had to take a 360-degree evaluation once every 3 years. And those 360-degree evaluations gave the opportunity not just for my boss, but for my peers and my subordinates to evaluate me anonymously. And then I would get the results and be able to do a self-reflection on how others viewed me. And this was the first time in my career, other than those two that I mentioned, that I had had such an evaluation. I am a huge fan of peer reviews of any kind, because you can find a very, very toxic environment. And the Navy is particularly at risk here when they assign a ship's captain, and then they send him off to sea for 6 or 7 months, and the ship is essentially the king. He or she can do whatever she wants while they're out to sea. And they have found over time that they have found people who are ill-suited for command too late after the fact, and have fired more ship's captains than I can think of because of that. So the Navy is now introducing 360-degree evaluations, which I think is a healthy thing to do. I had one more story, if I may. When I was hired for the job that I just left 9 years ago, one of the questions I was asked was, if you had 30 seconds of time in the elevator with a selecting official about why you're the right person for this job, what would you say? And my answer was simply, I would tell that person, the selecting official, you can talk to anybody who knows Craig Weldon, anybody who's worked for Craig Weldon or who has worked with Craig Weldon, and they're all going to say the same thing. I wanted to make sure that interviewer understood that I was an open book, what you see is what you get, and that I had nothing to hide. And I was not going to be one of these bipolar leaders that too often organizations discover too late.
Yeah, it's interesting. The British Navy actually had quite a good way of dealing with that in the 19th century. If you had a captain who flogged too much, they disappeared overboard one night and the officers turned a blind eye to it. There are quite That's a few technique. Cases of that one. It's a good technique, right? Now, I think I completely agree with peer review. And I would say peer review in special forces, I do work with the SAS in Australia and elsewhere, is very powerful. Partly because special forces attract people who are both physically and mentally very fit. Yeah. And they're highly dependent as teams. So you can get a level of honesty there. And you tend to get more honesty in military environments than commercial environments. The problem with 360 in commercial environments is it's very heavily gamed. Because it's linked to promotion, people learn to play the game about who does the peer review. The anonymity isn't really anonymous if it's any way close, and it creates a huge amount of psychological stress. So one of the things we've been doing as an alternative to that is, as a leader, you nominate people in four categories. So people you can order around whose names you hardly know, experts whose opinion you rely on, people you've got a good relationship with, you naturally work with them without a problem, and people who you've worked with in a crisis. And every time those people interact with you, they tell a story about the encounter into software. And then they interpret it only onto positive scales. So they can't say anything negative about you. But you balance positive qualities like altruism, assertiveness, analytical capability. So they don't know what the right answer is. And that has a whole body of qualities. And then you can literally see those patterns in real time. So you're getting continuous feedback. And then we look at feedback over the whole year rather than a single game environment. So there's a lot of new work coming out on 360, but the principle of peer review and peer recognition, I think, is absolutely vital.
Well, that's so, Dave, with your work, is this is something that you're seeing just in the military or is also in corporate space as well?
We're seeing corporate space, it's been gained. So when I was in IBM, I actually set up a website where you could nominate yourself to be somebody's third quartile responder. And I wasn't the only one to do that, all right? So commercial, you have to realize that the KPI structure and the targeting structure in commercial and the lack of long-term commitment, people don't join the military just to get short-term rewards. They do in industry. So gaming is far more common than in military environments. And any explicit, and this is called Goodhart's law in economics, any measure which becomes a target will cease to be a measure. So the minute you target it or make a reward, people will start to game the system rather than do the thing the system is meant to measure. Mm. And that's why we'd be doing this work to find ways that people can't game. Because I'll tell you this, in industry, you don't get to be C-level without extensive political capability and gaming capability. Mm. Now, so it's a different context, yeah?
Yeah.
But the principle is vital. The principle of peer review is absolutely critical. Mm-hmm. It's how you do it which changes a bit.
Let me add a vignette, a true story. It's in my book that, you know, what is it you're trying to achieve in the end? I worked for a three-star general once who was the consummate gentleman. He was very, very bright. He was very, very capable. Everybody liked him. He never raised his voice in anger, ever. And one day, a colonel came up to me and told me that General so-and-so was the toughest guy he ever worked for. And I looked at him a little curiously and said, "Why is that?" And he responded by saying, "Because I never wanted to disappoint him." And I thought that was such a powerful statement about inspiration and what you really strive to achieve in leadership is not for people to be motivated by the crack of a whip, but to be motivated because every day they want to wake up and go to their organization and do the right thing for the organization, do the right thing for the boss so that they don't disappoint. They don't become the reason for failure because they have so much pride in what they do and so much investment, personal investment in what they do and so much dedication to the people that they work for. Then you've really hit kind of nirvana.
Yeah, and I think I'll come back to the point I made earlier. The average length of service in military is significantly more than in commercial. Mm-hmm. And the level of commitment is higher. I think it's quite interesting. There's some evidence on this. I worked for the World Council of Churches for a long time on various stuff in Latin America and Africa and Australia. And you could always fall back to a common belief system to give coherence to the group. So you had a validation technique. And you got the same in military with things like loyalty, commitment, service, yeah. And patriotism, yeah? You don't have that in industry. So if you move into an organization which doesn't have a sort of shared, you know, value belief system, which has grown organically, you can't just construct it. It takes time to build that. Yeah. And it may not. And that's the danger with porting things from one environment intact to the other without realizing the context has shifted.
How do you help to build that more organic values system?
I think you do it by interaction. One of the key complexity principles is how people connect matters more than what they are. Mm-hmm. So changing connections, changing groups, moving people around, disrupting negative groups is a lot easier than trying to train people. And a lot of the organizational change consultants are obsessed with individual change. Doesn't work, doesn't scale. Yeah, managing roles, managing functions, managing interactions. Military can do this easily because they can just swap somebody out of a crew role and put somebody else in, and the other person knows how to interact. Hmm. Yeah, if you're a weapons officer, you're a weapons officer. You can go on any ship and do it. And so I think that's what you start to do in industry. You start to focus on identity and roles, not individuals and linkages. And then the sort of culture comes with it.
Hmm. What do you think about that, Craig, from your perspective and work?
Yeah, so in the military, you have typically people are only in an organization 2 or 3 years. The commander comes in typically only for about 2 years. And so to set the conditions for success, that commander or leader needs to make sure people understand from the very beginning the direction that he or she wants the organization to go, those things that are important, those things that are less consequential, and those things that are irrelevant, but also those things that are not negotiable. I sat down at my kitchen table in 1989 and wrote out a commander's philosophy, which was the first time I had done that in 16 years in the Army, because my organizations to that point had been small enough so that people knew me very well. But at that point, I had 1,000 soldiers under me, and I thought, I'm only going to be here 2 years. I better set the tone for this organization early on because the clock is ticking. And then every month when newcomers came in, I would sit down with newcomers and go over with them my philosophy of command. They get a copy of it, a hard copy, but I'd talk to them about here's what this organization is here for, and here's the most important parts of it. Here's the role that you play in it. Here's what I think you should know, and here are the non-negotiables that I won't put up with. I also developed a presentation called Weldon on Weldon, which was a sort of a self-reflection on myself and my leadership style. And I gave that to everybody. And it was kind of a full Monty. It was strengths and weaknesses and everything else. I validated that with a number of people who had known me, worked for me, worked with me, or I had worked for over the years. And I still use it to this day. In fact, it's appendix, both those items, my philosophy of command from 1989 and the Weldon on Weldon presentation, are appendix A and appendix B in my book as tools for other people to use if they see any value. But you got to get off the starting blocks quickly when you're a new leader and set the tone and the direction because the clock is ticking. And people have told me that often in the corporate world, their tenure is often only a couple of years and then they're gone. And nothing's more frustrating than, you know, getting a new leader in the organization. In 2 or 3 months, you're still scratching your head trying to figure out, you know, what exactly does this person want me to do? And so it's important to tell people that early on.
I can give you a case on this, which is actually military. It's what we do with NAVAIR in the Mojave. And what we did actually there is we captured people's, it's called a non-hypothesis research method. So we were capturing the stories from people in NAVAIR of what they would tell their best friend if they were, you know, kind of like you're a grandparent, your grandchild wants to join the Navy, what will you tell them? That's a non-hypothesis question. So we were gathering those stories and getting people to self-interpret them. And then we picked off the stories told with high emotional intensity from a sort of perspective of everybody should hear this and I'll never forget it. We put those together, printed them off, and gave them to the incoming commander. So he knew the stories which mattered to people before he actually got involved. And that was very, very successful, particularly in NAVAIR, because it was one of those transitionary 2 to 3 star command jobs. So it had higher turnover than most. But that understanding the day-to-day stories of how people saw their jobs made a huge difference to the incoming commander. So I think we're given two examples of one is input, the other is output, and both are important.
Same church, different pew.
Yeah, exactly. What I was thinking too there is, you know, is there a level of self-awareness that the leader needs to have to be able to really understand these stories? I mean, with Craig, I love the idea of having the Weldon on Weldon and really, like, you know, sharing your own insights on yourself with others. And that expresses like a high level of self-awareness. But how much does that play into leadership? Is it essential or not?
I think it is absolutely essential. Let me give you another example, and I think David will hopefully validate this as well. About 30 years ago, I think it was the Army, perhaps not, but the Army introduced a thing called the After Action Review, and it's unique to the United States military. I haven't found many other armies, and at that time, I was heavily embedded into the European nations. Through NATO, because I spent much of my time in the military growing up during the Cold War, and I spent 10 years in Europe. So I'm very familiar with how the Germans, the Brits, the French, the Belgians, the other NATO countries, their militaries operated. In any case, back to the After Action Review, we decided that for a training event or an operational event, that there was great value in, after the event, peeling that onion back layer by layer and finding out what did we do right, what did we do wrong, and how can we improve to make it better the next time. And we just ingrained that into our processes so that it became part of our psyche. And oftentimes the after action review would start off by the leader himself standing up and saying, okay, here's what I did right today and here's what I did wrong today. And they would, and it was anathema, certainly to the Eastern European countries, because I started to work with them after the Cold War, for a leader to stand up and admit that he made a mistake. You just didn't see that happen in Eastern European countries. And there were some Western European countries where that would have been very difficult to achieve as well. But that ability to do some self-reflection and tell subordinates that, hey, I screwed this up. And my commitment to you is that I'm going to learn from it and not make that mistake again. Very, very powerful.
And I make a couple of points. I mean, I know the AR process, and I think it's valuable. We also do during action reviews. Yeah. So, for example, we used a narrative approach with West Point working in Afghanistan. One of the scary things, though, is you find if you capture learning during the event, the learning is different from how people reflect. And there's some cognitive neuroscience on this. We remember the past to meet the needs of the present. So we've added to the AAR process by actually capturing narrative in the field under fire and using that to inform the AAR process. So I think there's some enhancements that can be done to that. I think the self-awareness that I think is good when you get it, but you won't often. People assimilate narrative faster than they assimilate written text. There's a famous day and I made on this, we always know more than we can say, we will always say more than we can write down. So people assimilate abstract narrative much faster than they assimilate doctrine. And we do a lot of work on narrative enhanced doctrine here. So narrative can increase the stimulation of self-awareness without the need for confession. And I think that's one of the key things. Some really gifted leaders, and you persuaded me to buy the book with your two appendices, are able to do the confession, but most aren't. So you have to create processes which don't require confession, but increase self-awareness.
Hmm. Is it because the confession, does it have like a cognitive effect?
That's you have negative, to be or? Very self-confident. Well, again, there's an old joke, right? Why is it that Catholics and Jews are the only two religions who make jokes about themselves? Which the answer is because we know we're right. Okay. So it's much easier to confess if you're self-confident. If you're not self-confident, confession is actually a weakness, right? Mm. And you have to find processes around that. And there's a lot of that relates to family background, early discipline. You know, get the right mentors. I've been really lucky. I've had five brilliant leaders in my corporate career. I mean, that's almost without precedent, right? Mm. And they all gave me space. I've seen people shattered by their first manager. And you have to rebuild their confidence. And they're not going to be that open until the confidence has been rebuilt.
Hmm. it's not really changing the subject, but I'm curious to hear what you think about this idea that, you know, I think I hear this a lot in general, that there's like this new type of leadership, or we need new types of leaders, or there's something maybe radically different or different about leadership in the future. And what are your thoughts on that?
I think there's a lot which hasn't changed. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a lot we could go back to, because actually there were higher levels of uncertainty in the 19th century, which are more comparable now. And there were leadership models then we can borrow on. I think there's a lot of leadership hype and the consultants just trying to sell another fad. Mm. The one thing I would say, which is new, is you've got to have rapid real-time feedback loop. You get far less reactive time, and you also get perception. And I mean, I've worked on DARPA programs, and John Poindexter was in charge of them. And remember, he was NSA. And I remember him saying, he said, when he was NSA, whenever he asked for advice, the agencies competed to have their advice accepted, not telling what he needed to know. Because when you can become a leader, people don't want to be not called to the briefing table. Hmm. So one of the systems we built under the DARPA program was a mechanism for you to go directly from an abstract representation to raw intelligence data. That's called disintermediation. So leaders need to be aware that the teams around them will start to filter what they receive. And it takes a lot of work and a lot of effort and process to overcome that. So I think the ability to handle real-time, non-filtered data is probably the big thing coming.
How about you, Craig? Your thoughts on is leadership changed? And is it changing? Is it something unique and different in the future?
I think you can go back centuries and, mm-hmm. and the basic principles of leadership. Yeah. I mean, you can look at writings of people like Sun Tzu and see that they're timeless. Some of the things that he put into his book. But to spin off on a little bit on what David just said, mm-hmm. I agree completely that it's important for leaders to be self-aware and to be confident. A good leader is going to be confident enough to be able to point out his or her own flaws to the organization. And I have found that when you do that, you actually inspire subordinates. I've given a number of presentations over the years where I've talked about failings of my own, either in my professional life or in my personal life. And when I get done, I've had a number of people come up to me, sometimes in tears, telling me how much they valued hearing that from a senior leader, somebody who they perceived at the beginning of my presentation had a near perfect life. So imagine for a moment an audience of 50, 60, several hundred people, and this retired two-star general and senior executive from the Marine Corps gets up there and talks about leadership. And the first thing people think is that, well, he must have done everything right because of the way he arrived at where he is. And the answer is, nope, not exactly right. So let me tell you about the bumps in the road that I discovered along the way. And I have found that demonstrating empathy to the failings and the shortcomings of everybody and showing a little bit of that yourself brings you closer to your audience and makes them believe you in more ways than you otherwise would have. So if you get up in front of an audience and talk about here's the way it should be, and you never bring forward any hint of failures of your own, then I think you're probably making a mistake, because people will listen, people will get closer to you if they understand that you're kind of like them, that you get out of the bed the same way they do, you put your pants on the same way they do, and you never really forgot your roots. So I have sprinkled throughout my presentations the hiccups that I've discovered along my life journey so that other people can see that, look, you can stumble occasionally and you can still succeed.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with that, although I'd have loved to be in the audience when George Patton did that, if he ever did it, right? I think there's something we've been playing with which looks very successful, which is called transgenerational pairing. So you pair a new joiner with somebody about to retire, and they do the knowledge capture learning. I call it the grandparent syndrome. So grandparents will tell things to their grandchildren, they won't tell to their children, and vice versa, because there's a different power relationship. So we've actually found that's quite a useful of embedding learning of failure, is to get that sort of pairing in place and capture micro failures rather than confession and build them. Yeah. So that's just a variation on the theme, but that ability to know that somebody who's been successful has failed is key for building confidence.
That's great. I want to be respectful of time, so I want to wrap things up here. And I want to end by just asking you both, just take a quick second and, you know, what can leaders do now to be more intelligent in the future? If Craig, you want to?
Yeah, so I encourage people to study others, read a lot, watch things that work well, observe things that don't work well. I have a metaphor in my book where I talk about picking up the rocks along the path of life, putting them in your rucksack so that you'll have them when it's time for you to use them. Pick up both the good rocks and the bad rocks. The good rocks so you can use them yourself, and the bad rocks to remind you not to use those. So they all represent good leadership behaviors, good life behaviors that you observe, and you say to yourself, wow, if I ever grow up and get into a position like that person, I'd really like to be like that. Or if I ever grow up and get into a position like that, I hope I'm never like that. And both of those have value in capturing and carrying along your life journey. I've got plenty of rocks in my rucksack, both good and bad. And I borrow and take from as many people as I can. You can get those out of a book, but you can also do that through what I call virtual mentorship, which means you don't have a person assigned as your mentor. Essentially, the world is your mentor. And as you go through your journey in life and observe behaviors of others, take the good and record the bad and sort them out when it's time for you to use them.
I'd go simple heuristic, all right? If it wouldn't work with a bunch of teenage children, why are you trying it out? I mean, the best training for leadership is to manage teenagers because you have to change the dispositional state so they're more likely to do the things you want without orders. And that's probably the best advice I could give to any leader. It's like managing teenagers. You know, you've got to go with the flow. And the other big thing you've got to learn is that you've got to cope with other people failing. If you can't cope with people working for you failing, you're not going to be a leader.
Hmm. And a final question, this one's maybe a little bit more challenging, is one word that you hopefully future leaders embody or take as like a core value, what would that be?
I would say ambiguity.
Ambiguity?
And I would say character. Character is the foundation of all good leaders. Without strong character, you have little. And you will eventually fail.
That's a lovely link, because Aristotle says if you build character, people can handle ambiguity. So we've got a link.
Well, thank you both, Craig and Dave. Really appreciate your time, your insights, and all the great work you're doing.
Great. Thanks so much for the invite.
Cheers, guys.
Thank you for joining us today on the Flowcast. To get a summary of today's dialogue, find out more about today's guests, listen to previous episodes, or discover more about Haku Global's neuroscience-based Futures Intelligent Leadership programs or customized strategic foresight and innovation sprints, visit us at www.haku.global. At Haku Global, we believe it is time for more Futures Intelligent Leadership. The future is something we need to think more intelligently and feel more deeply about so we can collaborate to discover today's solutions for future problems. If you are in a leadership role and need support or training to scale futures intelligence across your organization, then contact us at Haku Global. This is your host, Tyler Mongan, and until next time, have a preferred and conscious future. Aloha.